bra cut.
Danny, will you please stop drinking vodka at my kid's birthday party?
And then you got a freaking miracle. There you go.
Welcome to the Abracadam Podcast, and I'm your host, stand-up comedy magician Danny Whitson. I hope my Abracadamets had a good week this week. Oh my gosh, it was a tough one for me, guys, because I was hoping to be back on track with my diet and exercise, but man, it just didn't happen. It did not happen this week. But it did get me thinking. I was like, you know, I would probably have ate more vegetables if they sat more appetizing, you know? And it got me thinking about, like, well, who named fruits and vegetables? Like, you know, I'm sure there's a good reason why an apple is called an apple and a good reason why a banana is called a banana. But what the hell were they smoking when they named an eggplant, you know? And I can guarantee you this. This person was super high. The guy who named the orange. They probably stared at it for like 2 days. Stoned out of his head and said, hey, it's orange. That's my thoughts on that. Also, I will say this, though. Cauliflower. I've got a better name for cauliflower. It's not appetizing, but it is very interesting. Feel free to use it. The new name for cauliflower should be honky broccoli. Yeah. Offer someone a piece of honky broccoli. They're probably going to be like, oh, well, let's try it. There you go. You're welcome. Okay. You ever get up in the middle of the night and you think you might see like a shadowy figure there in the corner of your bedroom? And then you get to looking a little closer and you're like, does he have my underwear? But then you realize it's just that big pile of dirty laundry that's been piling up in your bedroom. That's right, folks. Today's episode is brought to you by Bob's Washboard Wash and Fold Services. Yes. Now, if you're anything like me, I hate doing laundry. And yes, dirty laundry can pile up. So don't hesitate to take your laundry to Bob's Washboard Wash and Fold Services, located at 122 Randolph Road, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Give Bob a call at 865-951-3237. Bob also offers a delivery service for anyone who's a senior citizen or homebound. Guys, doing your laundry has never been easier. All you have to do is take your big old pile of dirty clothes, drop it off, come back, and your clothes will be clean, dry, and folded and ready to go. Bob's Washboard Wash and Fold Services. Check them out today. This episode is also brought to you by the Grove Barbershop. Now, guys, I've been getting my hair cut at the Grove for a long time, and owner and operator Jeff Hackler is an awesome barber. And the best part is, all you have to do is just make an appointment. You go online to thegrovebarbershop.com, select your time, select the day, and then show up. You show up, everything is clean, organized, and it's just you and Jeff. He gets your hair cut, get you looking nice, and get you out of there in no time. So be sure to check out the Grove Barbershop located at 98 Randolph Road, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Give Jeff a call if you want to at 865-482-2210 and make your appointment at thegrovebarbershop.com. Okay, I am super excited about today's guest on the Abracadam Podcast. He is a giant in the world of comedy magic. And that is an understatement. I'm not going to say a living legend because he doesn't like to be referred to as a living legend, but he is a giant in the world of comedy magic. There's absolutely nothing this guy has not done in comedy magic. He has been on television shows. He has done everything. And, you know, one thing I really enjoyed is you can go back and see some of the very old clips of him doing stand-up comedy. And he does such a perfect mix, too, of mixing stand-up comedy and magic and just making a trick funny. He is a master. He is a true master at the art of comedy magic. And some of the most interesting stories, because this guy has lived a comedy magic life. And it's just, I loved this episode. I love this interview. So if you will, Abracadamets, sit back and relax and enjoy my fun conversation with comedy magician giant Nick Lewin.
All right, I'm excited today on the Abracadam podcast. We got the living legend, comedy magician Nick Lewin. How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing great. Living legend. I don't know. When you start to hear that, you get a little bit worried. I did a show recently, and they had the living legends of comedy magic, and that kind of worried me. At first, I was excited, and then my mentor, an old Irish magician, Billy McComb, I remember him leaning across to me one day and saying, Nick, be careful. The moment they call you a living legend, that means you've got less than 10 years to live. He said, the only worst thing they can say is if that you're beloved. That means you've outlived all your enemies.
Billy McComb, wow. That's what that explains a lot, too, with you. I tell you what, Nick, if you don't mind, do you care to introduce yourself to the listeners?
I would love to. As you can tell from my accent, I was born in Georgia. Originally, I was born in England, and I started doing magic at about the age of 11 and performed shows after that time around England. But then I started to work on a cruise ship, which was exciting. I went out to Australia when I was 20 and traveled around. And eventually, I ended up going out to California. I moved out to California in 1974. So I've celebrated over 50 years as a full-time comedy magician, and I kind of do both. I'm a comedian and a magician. I've done just about everything you can do in the business one way or another. I've done a bunch of TV, a lot of acting work, which was fun, though I think I've spent all the money now. I used to do a lot of Vegas work. I used to, back in the 80s, there were wonderful opening gigs, and I used to open for people like Reba McEntire, Tony Bennett, and that was a lot of fun. Those were the great days. You'd go out and do 15 minutes in Vegas and to a great audience, and I'd work comedy clubs. I did 11 years headlining comedy clubs across the country, and just now I've ended up here in Austin, Texas. I love the music. I'm almost retired. You never quite retire when you're a comedy magician. It's like being a spy or a secret agent. You may think you're retired, but they can bring you back into the fold. All it takes is waving a check. So that's about it for me. Other than that, I've been a member of the Magic Castle. That's our big magic group out in LA. And I've done shows for a lot of great people over the years. And you tell me the stuff that I've worked for David Bowie. I'd actually known David back in England. We had a mutual friend, and we were both Anthony Newley fans. And I got to work for him. I've worked for Orson Welles, Cary Grant, David Niven, Jimmy Stewart. I did a whole thing with Duran Duran. I've done just about every kind of work there is over the years.
Wow, that is amazing. Gosh, that is amazing.
When I was a kid, I remember at school, I was just doing kids' birthday parties, and they had a vocational guy come and talk to us about what we were going to do for a living. You're going to have to really think about what job you want. I'm happy doing, I like doing my magic shows. He said, only real job. You can't make any money doing that. And I said, well, so far it's not bad, and I'm only 15. And he said, well, what can you make? And I told him, and he was kind of shocked. He said, well, that's really good money. I said, yeah, it ain't bad at all. And I kind of worked that one out early on.
Wow. Now, so you were young into magic. Now, were you always, do you think you were born funny, or did you just kind of get into comedy later, or how did that happen?
Well, I love comedy from the earliest age. Comedy and magic were, they were two things that I loved. I've always been a magician. I never wanted to be. I used to say in the, when I worked the comedy clubs that people say, are you a magician or a comedian? And I'm a magician. I had a happy childhood because all the comedians, none of the comedians like that. They're all there.
That's so true.
At least 10 minutes of their acts were about getting beaten and badly treated. But I always had a very good childhood of those things. But I love comedy from, I grew up listening to comedy albums, 10-inch LPs. That's something that's doubly, trebly out of date now. But people like Victor Borge and Americans like Bob Newhart. So I really knew that it was always going to be comedy. I never wanted to do a serious act. And I think a lot more people like to laugh than like to be fooled. So that has a lot to do with it.
Now, unlike a lot of magicians that use comedy in their name of their act, Nick, you can do stand-up. You are a stand-up comic. You are very good at stand-up.
Oh, absolutely. And when you were doing the clubs back in the 80s, if you wanted to be really, you were treated with a great deal of disrespect if you were a magician, because it was, oh, he's got props, he has to do tricks. And, you know, and the comedians got very, very funny because, you know, if it was a bad audience and they weren't laughing, hey, I just do magic. And, you know, and win them over with the magic, which was a different skill set. So they always thought that was cheating. I thought it was good career planning to be able to do that. But I never wanted to be a comedian, but it was very essential back in the comedy club days. I used to work everywhere. I mean, New York, Alaska, the South, almost every state I think I did work in. I think there's maybe two I didn't, but I worked everywhere and the comedy worked everywhere, which was another whole thing. There was a lot of regional acts. There were very few people who were really able to work on a national basis because the comedy didn't translate as well. But I always used to start off doing about a 10-minute comedy monologue. So you came out and that way they realized that you were funny. They realized that you could be a stand-up comedian. Then you went into it. That way nobody had any, you know, I didn't have to put up with anything from anybody.
I do the same thing with my act is, you know, I open with stand-up and my jokes and then move into the magic. And, you know, I've kind of found the same thing, you know, people don't mess with you. It's kind of funny how that works. So.
Well, they don't. They really don't. So I always enjoyed that. And, you know, I used to work at the comedy store. It was never something I enjoyed, particularly in L.A. That was really the comedians where they went and played to get their breaks. Everything was centered in L.A. It was all about putting together the 6 minutes for the Tonight Show set. And everything was geared towards that. And that was not the same with me because the guys who worked at the Improv or the Comedy Store, they would be, you know, working to get those 6 minute sets. They would line up and open mic night. Then when they got good enough, Mitzi would say, okay, you can have a set. You're on at 1:30 in the morning on Monday night. And there'd be like two people there. And we didn't have that at the Magic Castle. We could go in there. And in those old days, it used to be 21 to 28 shows a week. So it was seven nights and three or four shows a night. So it was a great way to learn. The only way to really perfect your craft is by getting stage time. You know, the comics were ecstatic if they could get, 50 minutes of stage time a week at the comedy store. And you can't, you can polish something into a real diamond shape. That's the way you would perfect your Tonight Show set. But it was not. And there were a lot of guys who got very, very funny, but they only had 7 minutes. You know, that was it. And I was always able to go out and do a full 45-minute hour show. And that's what happened in the comedy clubs in those days. Somebody would go and do a terrific Tonight Show set. Then they get booked for a club. And then they'd arrive, and they just didn't have that hour's worth of material. They had that 7 minutes that they'd done on the Tonight Show. But you couldn't even repeat that particularly, because you'd already done it. So there was a little bit of that going on. And of course, I worked with many great comedians during the course of that time. It was quite an education, you know, the Seinfelds, and I got to make some pretty unusual friends. Sam Kinison became a good friend, and he was a piece of work. He was really something. Ray Romano. I mean, we all have those same great stories. I remember Ray Romano opening a show for me, and within 2 years, I'm going, oh, I wish I had 1% of his income this year. But he was the nicest guy you could ever imagine. So many of them, I don't really remember meeting that many magicians or comedians in that circuit who weren't pretty nice people. There were a few, but it was a nice deal. And then I did a lot of Vegas work, I ended up doing more and more shows in Vegas, Tahoe, Atlantic City, Reno, and then primarily it ended up being Vegas. At a certain point, I've got two daughters, Natasha and Katrina, and when they were born, when they were about 4 years old and 5 years old, to me it was a little difficult because I was on the road the whole time. And Katrina, my youngest, who always was so excited when Dad got home from being on the road, you know, oh, she was excited, laughing, Daddy, Daddy. I arrived home one time. She was quite a drama queen. And I arrived at the front door with my case, and she just burst into tears and hugged my leg and said, Daddy, I forgot what you looked like. Talk about a dagger in the heart. So that's what I decided I should think about something different. I was doing a lot of those Vegas dates at that point, and we came up with the idea of doing I was working most of the casinos at one time or another, but I was working at the Maxim, which was a fun little slightly off the strip little casino. Had a nice showroom, 150 people. You could pack in it if the fire department wasn't looking. So I decided it might be fun. At that time, there'd never been an afternoon show in Vegas. There'd been one. It didn't really count for various reasons, but there'd certainly never been one person coming out just performing their show. So I said, you know, I think it'll work, and they were very supportive. So we decided to do that. We called it Comedy Magic, and good title, huh? And went in, and I had a good publicist in town, and we bought some covers, and we did a 2-month run to see if it was going to work. And it was at 1 and 3 in the afternoon. And I thought it was really going to work because that was the time when Branson was doing very well, and they were doing morning shows, afternoon shows. Yeah, they had it all down. And everyone said, oh, you can't do a day show in Vegas. This is a night city. This is a night city. That's never going to work. And I said, well, I think it is. I have a feeling it gets really hot in the afternoon in the summer, and there's people. And we did really well from week one. We pretty much sold out. It was a small room, so you know, if you filled it up, the place was just packed out, and it was very, very exciting. And I stayed there for 5 years, so that was one of my longer runs. And I only left when the casino closed. At one point, it became very abundantly clear to me that the casino was going to close. So that was time to move on. And the guy who used to fill in for me there was Mac King, who's a wonderful comedy magician. And so Mac, I was doing 2 shows a day, 6 days a week, 48 weeks a year. Then the 4 weeks I took off, Mac would come in and fill in. And he was, of course, a wonderful comedy magician, and it was great. So when it was time for me to leave, he took the show basically exactly as it was, the ticketing, everything, went out with it to Harrah's. He did the smartest thing, though. He cut it down to 6 days a week. 5 days a week, because six was really hard work. And he's been there, I think, 85 years now or something. A long, long, long time, over 20 years, 25 years. And so nowadays, prior to quarantine time, I would go in and fill in for him. So the entire thing kind of had a nice circle to it. It was, you know, the circle of life without all the lions. I was able to go into Vegas to Harrah's and do his dates whilst he went off to do something else.
I had actually talked to Steve Bargatze about that, about him filling in for Matt King on his show. And he brought this up, and I didn't even think about how much pressure it must be filling in on someone's show, especially when they're there to see someone else.
Well, it never worried me, because I got 5 years under my belt doing the exact same length of show to the exact same kind of audiences at the exact same times. So I never thought twice about it. I would just go, and I never had a problem. And in many ways, I'm a much higher energy act than Mac. He's amazing because, you know, he just seems to be happening. And I go in there, there's a little bit more, you know, razzle tazzle, not props, but I mean, there's a lot of energy going on. So I never had a problem with that at all.
Now, of course, you know, I would always love to have an opener to warm up the room. You know, that always makes the headliner's job easier. But my act is also a high energy act. And I've had those times to where I've had to go into a cold room, and it's never really scared me. In some cases, it's almost like a challenge, and it becomes fun. Did you ever get that, Nick?
Yes, and I've also, over the years, I've worked on cruise ships quite a bit, which is great work. I did my first cruise at, as I said, 20, and I carried right on. I did just about 47, 8 years going off on ships. And sometimes you'd have a rotten audience on a ship because, you know, if everybody had been walking around Rome for the day, it had been, 95 degrees, they were exhausted, and you're in the showroom, and it's the late show. I mean, that's about, they were a deadly audience. Now, you might hit them 2 days later when they've been at sea and they're totally geared for it and they're the best audience in the world. It never worried me, Cole. I think the important part is you have to go into it. And sometimes when you say cold, sometimes the problem is that the numbers are not enough, to be honest. And you look out and to be honest, that was sometimes a problem for everybody at Harrah's with Mac's show. Sometimes you'd look out and you'd find there was 40 or 50 people in a 400-seat showroom. Oh. Why? Because there's a convention in town. Who knows why? You know, other times it would be packed. And that's another whole thing. And that would happen on the cruise ships too. Sometimes you go out, and because those cruise ships got very big when I started, they were little showrooms that seated, you know, 150 people. By the time I left, they were like performing arts centers. They had hydraulic stages and 3,000 people in the audience. But if the show was early evening and they'd been out in port all day, sometimes you'd go out and you'd find that there was just a couple of hundred people in a 3,000 seat showroom. Very difficult. So I always made a point of being very nice to the people who were there. Comedians, there's a certain comedic rage. I think most magicians have been kind of entitled as kids, because it's very expensive to be a magician. The props, the gimmicks, the gadgets, the downloads, the books, the DVDs, the conventions. I mean, you know, comedians for the most part came from a slightly different jumping off point. And I always refer to comedic rage, because there's a little bit of anger behind most of the comedians, even the nice ones. There's an edge that there really isn't with many magicians. One or two, but not many. So sometimes I would see a comedian come out and do that show where it was just, to a room or in a comedy club, whatever it was, they would be really mean to the people who were there. Just, you know, they would just be, oh, well, you're not getting it, or whatever it was. I always thought that was the biggest mistake in the world, because they're the people who did take the time to get there and be there for you. So that was one thing I've always tried to do, is to be very aware of the people who are there and realize that they are what's going on. And that's why you're there, and that's why you get a check at the end of the week.
You know, I've seen comics come out there and with that rage, and in the audience isn't, you know, liking their material, so they take it out on the audience. And, you know, I've always said, you know, some shows are fun and some shows are work. And the nights that it's work, you know, I kind of look at it like a plumber. You know, it's my job. I'm here to fix this. I'm here to do my job. And we hope it's fun, but sometimes it is work.
Well, that's it. I've always been a journeyman. It's what I do. It's what I've always done. And if I look back on it, I'm not sure I would have done it all over again. I kind of went into it, but it's been a very good life. I've been great places. I've got to do an awful lot of different things that I've enjoyed. I can't say I was, you know, read about and hear comedians or performers who talk about the applause as everything. I live for. I never quite felt that way. I always felt a little bit disconnected from it. And to be honest, my, generally speaking, at the end of a show, whether it's a great one, an okay one, or a bad one, I come off and I go, I'm glad it's over. And I'm glad nothing went desperately wrong, you know, because that can happen. You never quite know what's going to happen. So I never found that. I always had my own little games going on in my mind. I enjoy every show I do. I do at least one or two new lines, and I would keep the show moving slightly. And I learned a lot of that on the comedy circuit. Comedians were always working on material. So I kept a lot of topical material in. I do a trick where I tear up and restore a newspaper, tear it into little bits, and then shoom it all. So you've got a, you know, you've got something in your hands, you're talking there, but you've got this lovely finish when the newspaper in slow motion goes back together and reforms. But it gives you a wonderful chance to do some topical jokes about what's happening in the day, because you can sometimes get a big laugh out of something because it was in the news that morning, and the day before or 2 days later, it wouldn't mean a thing. So that forces you to keep your mind focused on the here and now, you know, that moment.
I've been so excited because things are starting to open back up and I'm all fully vaccinated now. So now I finally get to tell my COVID jokes. But you know, one of the special things about you, Nick, is just like your torn and restored newspaper routine, is no one can do that like you, because you put Nick Lewin in that act. So that's just one of the things I love about seeing that routine. I love it.
Well, and that's what you need to do. It's very important. And if I would say one thing about magicians, that there's so much stuff written about magic and printed and magazines and every kind of media, that magicians tend to think that if they want to find a new routine, they look somewhere and they will take something that's already been created and put down. And if it works, they tend to stick with it a bit. Whereas you really need to make sure that you form it into something fresh and new, and that it's based on you and what the audience see of you that's going on. And comedians are always very tough on magicians. They say, oh, you guys all do the same tricks. You know, I wish I had a buck for every time I've heard that. And then you go out and after a short while, you go, yeah, and comedians all do the same topics. If you took away wife jokes, girlfriend jokes, driving jokes, it's the same thing. They always say, though I couldn't prove it, that there's only seven tricks in magic. Some days, if I'm really on a roll, I could name the seven, but they tend to change. But I think it's the same with comedians. They have you know, whatever it is. They don't realize that they're really basically doing exactly the same thing. What they're doing is they're finding a way to individualize a topic that maybe a dozen other comedians are doing. And where it gets tough sometimes for a magician is if they don't get enough shows, they will do something and they will take a real hunk of someone else's personality, and they will do patter that they found written down or on YouTube or in a joke book, because they don't give the full respect to what they're saying. Magicians tend to be very, very focused on what they're doing. And the way everything looks, and in fact, when you're doing comedy, it's all about how you what you say and how you say it. I listen to magicians, and they look like they've spent sometimes, you know, years working on a sleight of hand, the way their hands move, and then I listen to what they're saying, and I wonder if they've even thought twice about what they're saying. They haven't come up with anything. Well, I'm going to take this box, I'm going to put it on this table, I'm going to remove the cards from the box, all things that everybody can see, you know. So what they should, that would be a perfect time to do a joke, to bring a different reaction from the audience. So there's that descriptive thing, or then there's, you know, people will say, this amazing Jonathan did this on TV, I like that, I'll just throw that in my act, it won't matter. And comedians, if you buy a joke, if you want to use a joke from a comedian, they'll charge you, you can be charged $200-$500 for a one-liner, if you really want a good joke from a good writer. And comedians don't, you know, and most of them really don't want to do that. When they get to the big time, oh, that's a different story, they need that material. Magicians seem to think you can often borrow those things, because other people won't know. And they do know, they really do, because if it isn't you, nothing comes across quicker on stage.
You know, I couldn't agree 100% more. And to me, I mean, I write all my own jokes, my own gags. I try to keep my tricks as originally as I possibly can. But to me as a performer, I don't know why anyone would want to do anyone else's act, anyone else's jokes. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I mean, I will tell you this also, you know, bombing on jokes is one thing, but bombing on gags is something completely, completely different on another level, because now you're standing there like a moron holding some prop that no one even understands.
Very true. Comedians have props too. That's why they like to have a mic with a wire and a microphone stand. They have their stool. They pick up a glass bottle of water. They take a sip at the right time. That's kind of replaced the old time, the Henny Youngman era of comedians, George Burns. They would, when they wanted to sell a joke, they would stop, take a puff on the cigar. And it was very much, it was a prop, because it wasn't that they needed to smoke a puff of a cigar at that point, but they needed a pause, and it was a natural reason. Just as now you see a Jay Leno, when you see him live, he is just orchestrated with when he will have a drink, a sip of water. It's not because he's thirsty ever. It's always because that's the correct moment to do it.
You know, I notice, like, you know, when I tell a joke and the peak of the laughter, and then the moment as it comes back down, I want it to last as long as I can possibly milk it, you know, but as it starts to come right back down, that's when I go back in, you know, that riding that wave is something too, you know.
Well, I think that's a good term. And I've often compared performing to surfing, because it's like riding a wave. And if you're standing up on that board and the force of the wave is behind you, you elegantly stand up. It looks like you're not exerting any effort. What you're displaying is balance. And then the force of the weight moves behind you from the water and takes you forward smoothly until you fall off.
which could happen. Well, let me do it, because you mentioned Billy McComb, and Billy McComb, for my listeners, Billy McComb was an amazing, amazing comedy magician. He was fantastic. So clearly Billy McComb was an influence on you.
He was a huge influence. He's an Irish magician, and he's, again, a very, very funny man. There's no question he could have made a living as a comedian if he hadn't have loved magic so much. And I met him at about the age of 11. One of the things that is very nice in magic is that you have a mentoring system. And really, throughout his entire life, he died at about 83. He would always go through, and when I was in Vegas, he'd come in to see the show, he would always take little notes in the back. And after the show, says, "Oh, Nick, old son, that joke you do, you might want to take just a beat longer after it." And I say, "Oh, really?" And next show I go out and I do it. Suddenly it would change from being a laugh into a round of applause just because I took one extra second on it. So that was part of the training I got from Billy. And he performed right up till he was 83. He used to open for the amazing Jonathan, who was just a crazy mad magician. I'm not sure how many people know him these days, but he was a monster in the field. He was, and I can say this unquestionably, the most successful comedy magician on the comedy circuit. All the rest of us who were good and did well, there was us, and then there was amazing Jonathan, who was, in a slightly different league. I don't quite know why. It was just there. But right through to the end, he was working in Vegas, and he had said to Billy, "Well, do you want to come? Well, come and do the little opening slot on my show." So Billy, who was, this dapper, gray-haired gentleman in his 80s, and this crowd of people for Amazing John would be screaming out front and chanting, "Jonathan, Jonathan." Oh, that's Rollerball. Well, something like that. "Amazing, amazing." And then the curtain would sort of quiver, and the voiceover would say, "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Amazing Jonathan." They'd screams, "Very special guest, Billy McComb." And then the curtain would open, and there was Billy standing in a nice shiny suit in the middle of the stage, and this entire young, crazy audience looking, "My God, it's like my grandfather's out there." And their mouths literally dropped open, and Billy would just look around from side to side in the showroom, say, "Right, say, I want you all to pay very close attention, because I'm going to be working rather quickly tonight, because it's rice pudding night in the home." And, and from that one joke, he had them in the palm of his hand. So I was very lucky. He was an amazing mentor.
Now, let me ask, did you ever know Tommy Cooper?
Oh, I did. I met Tommy back in England. He was a force of nature. He was very, very tall. I'm 6'2". And he must have been at least 6'5". And everything went wrong. He was just, he was more comedy than magic. There was a general, the American equivalent would be Carl Ballantyne, the great Ballantyne, who was a great comedy magician. I did indeed know Tommy. He was an inspiration to everybody. He wasn't a mentor, but he was certainly an influence.
Well, I love Tommy Cooper. I love looking at old Tommy Cooper stuff and laughing hysterically. I can watch Tommy Cooper on YouTube forever. And Amazing Jonathan was a big influence on me too, seeing Amazing Jonathan. And also you, Nick, like I said, you are just a solid comedy magician.
I'm beloved. All the rest are dead. No, they're not. They're still alive. Okay. I'm still a comedy legend then.
Go ahead, Nick.
No. Carry on. You're asking great questions. I'm enjoying this a lot, this interview.
Well, okay. Well, tell you what, I want to get this out here. I do, because on the Abracadam podcast, we always ask a hell gig story. Do you got a good story for us? Something where something crazy happened? Something.
Well, I do, and I'll think of one I haven't done before, because particularly this year, there's been a lot of podcasts going one way or another. Yeah. I was at the Magic Castle once. Now, do you remember the show Fantasy Island?
Yes.
And,
yes.
Okay, and that was Ricardo Montalban, who was incredibly sleek and elegant. Well, I don't know if it was a hell gig. It was sort of a hell gig, but I won at the end. So that's the story I'm going to tell. Little Hervé Villaches was the small person, I think that's correct,
yeah.
Who was in a white matching white suit, and he was in the show, and he was at the Magic Castle. He was just drunk and obnoxious, and there's not much you can do when someone is a well-known TV performer, he's 3 foot tall and he's being a real jerk, and I'm cleaning up some of the things I might say. So anyhow, I was in the show and I was being, and he heckled right the way through my show. There's not, you can do certain things. I couldn't quite get back into and everything was off, and everyone felt sorry for me. No performer wants you to feel sorry. I was just ignoring it and going back and forth. And then I used to do a trick where I'd borrow a $20 bill. Then I would tear the corner off it and give it to the person who loaned it to me to own. I'd say, oh, you hang on to that. Then I'd burn the rest of the bill. And eventually, after some funny stuff, you would find that you'd restored the bill. And then you say, do you have that piece of the dollar bill? And oh, look at that. It fits. It doesn't. It's not only a fit, it's practically a bloody seizure. That was my closing. And I'd hold it up, the piece would fit. So anyhow, it had just, the whole show had just been strained is probably the word. And I've had some gigs that were so bad, I actually enjoyed them. But when they're strained like that, and you can't say what you want to say, because I was at the Magic Castle, very proper, in a comedy club, I would have had a totally different response. So in the end part, I said, I need to borrow $20. Ah, I got one. And he jumps up in the front row and he takes out a 20. And I said, oh, okay. And I ripped the corner off and I gave it to him. As I'm turning back, I notice he put the corner in his mouth and he swallowed it. So I'm going, oh my God, I got no finish to my bloody trick now. The little jerk has just, so I'm going, but I had time a little bit to think about. So I did the whole routine. And the joke I used to use, which was very risque for the castle, very clean for a comedy club, at the end, I'd say, oh, look, I've got, there's a piece missing. And I would say to the person in front, sir, do you have your piece in your hand? I'll rephrase that. Do you have the piece of the dollar bill in your hand? Which was a nice little laugh, not a huge laugh. But so I did this line, and there he goes. I said, do you have your piece in your hand? It gets like a little laugh. No, I ate it. I said, you ate it? You ate your piece? I said, that must be one of the very best benefits of being so short. And the place, absolutely, it was like the ultimate vindication, because, so that was what, but I've had some other ones. There's been less dramatic moments. I was once at a Hollywood big star event, and it was just these big events in Hollywood, you would do them, and your manager would say, oh, hey, you're going to get discovered. The moment anyone says you're going to get good exposure, you're going to get discovered, just say no to the gig. What they mean is it's going to be awful, you're going to hate it. So I did one of them, and just nobody was listening, nobody was doing anything, and I'm trying to do a trick where I'm teaching someone to do movements with their hand. He's not listening, he's not paying attention. And I did, and it's the last time I've ever done this. I was just really mad, and I used the oldest, stockest line in the business. And it's the one that got George Bush Sr. Out of his office. I said, hey, read my lips. And who played the Amazing Hulk?
Lou Ferrigno.
Lou Ferrigno, who of course cannot speak. It was one of those, and the entire room from this, suddenly there was like a gulping of breath, and I went, oh, well, that was a bad one. Okay, so that's it. Sometimes you say things and you do well, sometimes you say things you do badly. So Not too many hell gigs. It's the strange part is you do a hell gig, and it's the one that a year later you remember, and you actually, oh, that was kind of fun. You don't enjoy it at the time. The good gigs all kind of blend into one, you know, but the hell gigs you tend to remember.
I kind of wish, though, I wish I had the story from the little guy from Fantasy Island heckling me. That's an awesome story.
I probably got about 50 like that. I mean, it's so surreal when you're there and this is going on. I kind of like fairly risque comedy, and that's really one of the reasons the comedy circuit worked for me, because England is a different thing. I mean, there's different kind of comedy for different places. I did have another disastrous moment. I'd been working in the South, and it was when Arnold Schwarzenegger had just married Maria Shriver, a Kennedy, you know, and so I was in the South, and I had this little bit I put together for my newspaper. I said, oh, just married, and the whole family's so excited. The whole family were really upset. They were hoping she'd hold out for Hulk Hogan. So that was part one of it was a three-part joke, you know, the law of threes. First one was, and then I said, well, but the only one who was happy was Teddy Kennedy, because now there are two Terminators in the family. This was a round of applause. This was killing throughout the South. And then I went to do a club in Boston. And, you know, I'm British. Little do I know. Boston. I'm there in the audience. They're loving the show. And I said, oh, that'll kill. And of course, I didn't really think he was the favored son, you know. And I did that. And there was, honest to God, there was a moment's silence. And then I thought, oh, they're going to kill me. And then somebody kind of laughed. And I got away with it. They went, oh, okay, he's not from here. And it was a pretty funny joke at the time. I mean, it was, but that was, you better stop me or I'll go through a million of those awful ones.
That was awesome. That was awesome. You know, there's something with those hecklers. You know, I had a heckler the other night, and, you know, he was giving some of the openers a hard time. And it wasn't so much a shutting them down, but it was almost keeping them at bay. You know, keeping him right there, and he wasn't too disturbing or anything. And the great thing is, at the end, you know, they come up and shake your hand. Oh, you were great. And then I sold him a shirt. So, there
you go. Well, very often, for the most part, they're drunk, and they think they're helping the show. One of the biggest mistakes, in my opinion, is to try and involve them in the show. I see comedians who get into, you know, debates, and they're going back and forth with them. You're not going to win, because they're either drunk or they're not funny. I'm a great believer in, if somebody is, the first thing I do is I just look at them. Pause for about that long, and that's dead air, and in a show it's even more dead, and then everyone would look, and I'd give kind of a no, don't do this kind of a thing, not a word, not anything else, and very often that would be enough. That would just really take care of it all. Now, if they went on, if there was a the funniest line ever was Steve Martin, who used to say, if he was heckled, you remember his best heckler line? He used to say, oh, I remember the first time I had a beer. Yes, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. But so what I would do, if that wasn't working, and if they were still continuing to come back at me, I would do two or three lines straight off, and not give them a chance to intercede. Boom, boom, boom. Laura threes, 3-3-3. And the last one was always a double laugh. I would look at them and say, by the way, you don't want to mess with me. I'm a magician. I snap my finger and parts of your body drop off. And that would get a big laugh, and I might not use quite parts of your body, drop off, and then there'd be a big laugh, and I would just look it back at them, I'd say, no big thing, and boom, and then I would just look at them, just ignore everyone else, they would make eye contact, and I'd say, the last thing you want is my total attention. You know what? That shut him up. And to me, the goal with the heckler is to shut him up. It's not to, I don't want to bring them into the show. I don't want to top them. I just want to shut them up, because it makes the rest of the audience very uncomfortable when people heckle.
It sure does. And that's you definitely don't want to bring them in the show. you know, luckily my guy, he was a little chatty. I shut him up, but I kept him at bay at the same time without, you know, because I could tell he was plastered. But like I said, you know, I feel like it was a big victory because, hell, he was so drunk he bought T-shirts. So,
hey, he's good.
Probably, I'll tell you this. I don't know if you know comedian Rodney Norman, but I was probably one of the funniest things I've ever heard a comic say to a heckler. And Rodney is very funny, but he's very low energy, you know, very funny, but very low energy kind of act. And he gets on stage and he starts doing his set and somebody yells something out. And Rodney just looks at him and says, "Please don't talk to me right now. I'm trying to do something." And then he just goes right back into his act. And he goes, "Oh," I mean, he just...
That's exactly right. So, but I mean, I've not really had a lot of the worst thing is indifference. If you have an audience that's indifferent because of whatever the circumstances, that's difficult because it's not one person. And that could, I did a show for Circle K, who I've like, I guess you got them out there in Tennessee. They've got the, like, you know, the little mini marts in the gas stations. And it was their big golf tournament in Phoenix, and it was the event they had with all their suppliers. So, and this was when the company was in Chapter 11, and they were just doing really badly, and there was a lot of fuss about whether they should do this or not, because here were they raising money for their charity, and in fact most of the people there were waiting because they hadn't been paid for the goods that had gone into the Circle K stores. So it was very touchy, and they had their golf tournament, and in the evening I was the entertainer, and quite a few tables were absolutely empty because people who'd supported the charity in the afternoon were making the point of not going to the event in the evening, and it was prickly, it was unpleasant. And then the CEO of Circle K came out whilst introducing me, and he before he introduced me, he said, "Well, I'm looking around the room, and I just feel terrible because I realize we must owe money to just about every single person in this room." Oh my God, the temperature went down to freezing, absolute hostility. And he instantly knew he'd said the wrong thing. And so, well, here's our entertainer, Nick Louie. And I walk, and it was like walking out into the bear pit or something. So I changed around the order of my show. And I went right my same dollar bill trick, which has many reasons why it's one of my favorites. And I said, I need to borrow some money. And I went over to the CEO. And I said, "Oh, okay, you've got a 20. No, not a 20. You've got 100. And I got 100 from him. And then I did it, and I just looked, and I said, "Well, I must be the only person in this room who can get money out of this bastard." And the entire room, they all laughed, and it was just, you know, we were back, the show went great. And at the end, the CEO rushed up and said, "Oh, thank God." He said, "That was such a terrible mistake on my part. I'm so glad that you knew what to do to set things right."
And that's why you are Nick Lewin. That's why.
On a good day, I'm Nick Lewin.
Okay, well, let's do this. Let's get into, okay, here's a tough question. And I might already know this answer now that I've heard you talk about this now. But, Nick, if you were stranded on a tropical island and you were captured by the indigenous people who had never seen any other type of man outside of their tribe, and you had to convince them you were a god in order for them not to roast you, what magic trick would you do?
What magic trick would I do? I would do the ambitious card. That's the one where you have a card, somebody selects it, and it keeps jumping to the top in increasingly different ways because it doesn't have one effect. Because it keeps going and it keeps building. A lot of magic you spend 10 minutes building up to a 15-second finale. But that's a trick that I've done on many, many occasions, and I have a variation variation on it that I came up with, that it allows you to really look like you're improvising, and you are improvising, and you can work with them. But instead of one effect, it's got about 20 built-in punches. So that would be one of them. I used to have a variation of that, and it's my best card trick. Actually, I'm going to release it. Now I'm sort of retired. It's my favorite card trick. It does everything in the world. I love sleight of hand magic. People who see me do comedy magic have no idea that my real love is quite complex card work. So I've got this one routine where the cards do everything other than stand up, walk across the table, and whistle Dixie. You know, they're just... I used to go in when I was doing a corporate meeting to sell a gig. We did some very big corporate shows back in the late 80s. With big budget shows, and I would be in there pitching for, you know, building the stage. I think my last really big show, I took out 36 people as part of my group. So these were big budget. I had a little standard thing I used to do. I would come in and I'd sit down in the board table, the meeting room, wherever you were. And I would, you know, everyone was waiting to talk turkey and, you know, what are you going to do for the show and how much is it going to cost? I said, I just came up with a new trick. I said, I don't want to be a pain, but I have to perform it now or it's going to be gone. If I come up with something, unless I perform, it won't be locked. Can I just take 4 minutes before we begin just to show you this? And this trick I had down. I mean, every move of it, it was like a machine, but I wouldn't do it that way. I said, oh, right, you take a card. Oh, no, you do. And then I'm going to spread them out here. And I would make it look like I was, you know, putting this trick together in my mind and recreating it. And then I said, well, thank you. I think I've got it down now. I appreciate you letting me do that. Now let's talk about your show. And you know what? It was great because they're sitting there. They've seen this amazing piece of magic. It looks like I came up with it on the plane getting to the meeting. So that was much the same thing, because sometimes those corporate meetings used to be a bit like being trapped on an island with indigenous people who were going to roast you. Had a few of those over the years.
I love the ambitious card. It's in my repertoire. It's one of my go-to card tricks to this day. You know, I agree with you. It is one.
Oh, it's a great trick. My other mentor in magic we didn't discuss is Ken Brook, who was a wonderful English magician. And really from the age of 15 through to 21, he was my mentor. And he's the one who really got me performing. But Ken always used to say he really trained me to be a professional magician and to make a living. One of the things he always used to say was, well, Nick said, never perform for magicians, because you'll find they don't like any of the tricks that real people like, and real people don't like any of the tricks that magicians like, because magicians see something a lot of times. Every magician has seen you know, hundreds and hundreds of ambitious cards routines, and they want to see the latest thing that somebody just downloaded from Penguin that's going to be forgotten a week later because it doesn't have that kind of plot or that kind of movement to it, but they haven't seen it before. So that's to me is an important factor. You have to remember that most people don't see a lot of magic. Most people don't go to a lot of comedy shows. They see it on TV, but of course TV is nothing like the same thing.
Not at all. Kind of on that topic, what do you think now with all these virtual entertainment? Kind of how's your feel about that?
Well, it's not for me. I've seen a few go. Justin Willman did a great show. I watched his show and I thought it was tremendous. It's what we're stuck with. If you can't perform live, and then the magicians all got into it. Suddenly everyone who used to want to talk double lifts, they just want to talk microphones, which camera they're using, and switch, if you have a stream. They moved into this whole, well, what lighting do you use? What's your backdrop? And I'm going, yeah, I've got a Samsonite Meteor mic here that I use. And I use, you know, so they had got into it big time. And I know some of them are still thinking, and there's going to be a certain amount of virtual magic goes on, because with the corporate shows, I think it's going to be a while before a company wants to put their executives, their clients, their R&D team in one room and risk taking them all out. So I think they'll give it an extra year. But a lot of magicians now think, oh, well, no, this is it. This is going to be here forever. I don't think so. I think it's going to be, once we get back to live shows, how much black art can you see? That's one for the magicians, but it's true. And you look to Australia, that's quite substantially ahead of where we are in the COVID quarantine epidemic, they've gone. The moment people started to open up again, Zoom shows just disappeared. Where I do think it's interesting is I've really enjoyed getting together with groups and having topics on magic, and we've been doing one a month, and I'm able to link together people and amazing degree of different countries, do a 2-hour session. It's a great learning tool.
You've got a fantastic thing that you're doing. I attended one of them actually on the comedy, almost like the comedy lecture where you've had.
Oh, with Fielding, that's right.
Absolutely, which I really enjoyed. I think there is some really good things out of this, just like kind of basically what we're doing right now. But I'm with you also. You cannot replace live entertainment. That energy you get with people in a room, it's just, you can't replace it.
Well, Zoom is never going to be as slick as TV. So it's not going to replace a TV show, a live show. At the moment, it's fun because we're all in this boat together. So everyone, it's what we're doing, it's what you do. Necessity is the mother of invention. So we came up with Zoom shows, and they're working. We'll look back on it. I've had some mugs made for our company, and actually selling quite well. I have a mug, and it's a classic Houdini poster. And then on the side, it just says, yes, but does he have a Zoom show? A lot of people have been enjoying that.
It's gold. Yeah. I love it. Well, I tell you what, Nick, for maybe some entertainers that are listening to this podcast, any advice on comedy, magic, anybody who may be thinking about getting into that world?
Sure. It's a good thing to jump into. But I think the most important thing is stage time. You don't ever say no to a show, because when you're starting off, you need that time on stage. That's your training. That's what you do. You cannot put together you can't do a graph of how to do a good show. You have to be able to be out there and do a lot of shows. You have to take a lot of notes. You have to see what works, what doesn't, make your mistakes, make note of your successes. I think you have to follow your heart and do it. Comedy is tough like that. There's really not a lot of leeway in the same way. You can be a class clown, and you can be the world's best class clown. Then you go down to a couple of open mic nights, and you either really bomb or you don't. And then you have to think, do I really want to make no money for 10 years? Magic's a little easier, that's why there's so many semi-professional magicians. There's no such thing as a semi-professional magician. Either you're a professional or you're not. What you're saying, I sometimes get paid for a show. Not the same thing. Quite a different thing. But it is a nice way to, magicians have a little bit more chance to work their craft. But the old comedy clubs were wonderful because there were so many shows. But my real learning grounds were the Castle, that for nearly a decade, I was working nonstop at the Castle, doing that 21 to 28 shows a week. The London clubs that I worked, I used to double. You had to double a club. So I had two that I worked. And my first show was at 10:30. And I would do it at one club. Then I had to walk about a quarter of a mile with my little working case to a show at their sister club, walk back, do the next one. And my last show was at 3:30 in the morning. But that was four shows a night, and I did that. And that was a real training ground, doing those things. And the ships were very good for me to learn. So it's all about the performing time. And I think whether you're a comedian or a magician, any entertainer, I think a singer even, the most important thing you have to do is to be able to measure how many words you're using and not use too many words. You dilute what you're saying if you use too many words. And if you can get the same reaction using half as many words, you're twice as strong as you were before. People fall in love with what they're saying, the words they use and their voice, and they think that's what's making at work. In fact, they could pare it down much more intelligently. My favorite story is Oscar Wilde, the great Irish playwright, poet, and apparently one day he was having dinner in London, and he bumped into a friend and said, "Oscar, how are you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm terrible. I'm awful. I'm just destroyed." And I said, "Well, what's the matter?" He said, "Well, I'm working on a new play." Friend said, "Oh, really? Is it that tough?" He said, "Yes. I worked all morning on it, and I put a comma in." So then I had a little lunch, and I worked all afternoon, and I took it out again. I'm just exhausted. You know, that's kind of what really being a craftsman is. You work to put a comma in, then you work to take it out. It's tiny little things that make the difference.
Gosh, that is so true. Nick Lewin, where can people find more about you?
I'm sort of retired now, to be honest. I'm moving in on 70, and I never want to be the oldest performer around. But I'm out there. I've got a website, nicklewin.com. I've also, for those magicians listening in, I have a company, lewinenterprises.com, and you'll put those in the notes probably. And what I have tried to do is to release all the material. There's some routines that I've worked on for decades, and I didn't want them just to disappear. So that's what I've been doing. So those are good places to catch up with me. And I pop up quite often if you watch the old TV channels. I did a bunch of acting work. I was in Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, Trapper John, Perfect Strangers, Misfits of Science, Amazing Stories, you name it, a bunch of those shows. Dynasty, I just got a check in for Dynasty. It was 29 cents. I did that 35 years ago.
And awesome.
I was in The Gambler with Kenny Rogers. So, you know, that's where people catch up with me for the most part. When I'm doing that, although I was out in your neck of the woods, I came out to the House of Cards in Nashville, and I had a blast. I did enjoy coming out to magic rooms, and whether I'll get back to that or not, I don't know. We'll see.
Gosh, let's hope so, because people need to get back out and see some Nick Lewin and laugh.
Thank you so much. This has been such a joy. And it's great you do a wonderful podcast here. I've done a lot of these, and it's very seldom you have such a real pleasure doing it. You've just got a great questions. It's a real easygoing conversation, and that's what a podcast should be.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Nick Lewin, for coming on the Abracadam podcast.
Thank you.
Okay, I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation as much as I did talking to the hilarious Nick Lewin. He is just a wealth of comedy and magic knowledge. This was a real treat for me getting to talk with him. And if you can, be sure to look him up on YouTube. Anywhere on the internet, you can see him performing. I promise you, you will enjoy every minute of it. And check him out at nicklewin.com. And if you're into magic, check out lewinenterprise.com as well. Also, guys, if you have not done so, once again, be sure to follow or subscribe to the Abracadam podcast on whatever platform it is you listen to. And if you are on Podbean, I highly recommend going on Podbean, giving the Abracadam podcast a follow, and give me a shout out, give a review. I would like to know what you think about some of these episodes. And if you do give a review, I will give you a shout out here on the Abracadam podcast. And like always, abracadamits, thank you for listening.
Abracadabra. Cut. Ew!
Will you please stop drinking vodka at my kid's birthday party?
And then you got a freaking miracle. There you go.